about Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Mames, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Tim Lockhart, and he'll be answering your most important questions on stillwater strategies. This show will be 90 minutes in length, and we're broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Tim a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure to sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill in your name and email address in the form on our homepage, and we'll keep you informed. This broadcast is being recorded, and will be available for playback on our website within about 48 hours after the show ends. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this program cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Tim Lockhart about stillwater strategies. Captain Bob Jaspers of Flats Time Charters will introduce you to the Mosquito Lagoon, Indian River, and No Motor Zone of the Banana River on the east coast of Central Florida. Only a short drive from Orlando, you will sight fish for big redfish, spotted sea trout, and black drum, as well as a seasonal snook and tarpon. Captain Bob is a lifetime resident of the area, and it shows in his knowledge of the local fish, flora, and fauna. Call Flats Time Charters now and arrange your next memorable adventure. You can reach Captain Bob at 321-631-4051. That's 321-631-4051. Or go to his website at www.flatstime.com. That's FLATSTIME.com. Before we introduce Tim, we'd like to let you know about the great gifts we have to give away tonight. For our drawing tonight, we'll be giving away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a one-year subscription to Fly Fishing and Tying Journal. So you have two chances to win tonight in our drawing. Now, if you haven't registered yet for the drawing, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and look for the link under Tim's section that says, click here to register for our drawing. Click on that link and fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away a copy of Tim Lockhart's book, Stillwater Strategies, courtesy of Stackpole Books. And you can find out more about all the books that Stackpole has to offer at www.stackpolebooks.com. It's www.stackpolebooks.com. So here's how you can win. You must be the first person to answer the question we ask at the end of the show. The question's going to be about something we talk about during the show, and you must submit your answer along with your name and location using the text box on our homepage. So listen closely, use your best typing skills, try to be the first one, and see if you can't win Tim's book, Stillwater Strategies. Tonight our guest is Tim Lockhart. Tim has 35 years of experience fishing in the Pacific Northwest, primarily in western Washington, and over time he's frequented numerous lakes and ponds in his region, more than he can count, and currently makes repeated visits to about a dozen of them. To a lesser extent, he fishes stillwater in eastern Washington, Oregon, Idaho, and the UK, and he has also fished throughout Washington, Oregon, Idaho, and Montana for a wide variety of other species, including bass, salmon, steelhead, and halibut. This includes use of fly rod and reel, and as well as conventional gear in lakes, rivers, and saltwater. At present, he fishes about 100 times per year, and he's had a successful career in banking for 20-plus years and is still at it. Still counting those dollars, huh, Tim? Well,
right.
Welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Thanks, Roger. And the only part where you scared me was when you started to go down the road of photographer.
Yeah.
Other than that.
Yeah, I had the wrong bio in front of me, so I apologize for that. But I caught it before I read the whole thing. That's good. So won't be the first time or the last time that I make a mistake here. So that's just par for the course. Well, good. Well, good to have you on, Tim. And finally, it seems like we're here in spring, at least in Colorado high country. I think we're done with snow, so I'm happy about that. I think you are, too, out there in the Northwest. So let's dig right into our questions for tonight. We've got lots of questions, as usual. And thanks, everybody, for sending them in. And feel free, again, to send them in as we talk here, and we'll try to answer what we can. And let's just start out, Tim, with, you know, what your definition of still water is and how you approached it in your book. So.
Sure, and I like that you're starting out with an easy one here to kind of break me into it. But I have a very simple definition of still water. It's pretty much just what it says, and so it can be any lake, small pond, large reservoir, although I haven't been in many of those, but basically anything where it's not a river, it's not the salt water, anything that would constitute lake or a pond, pretty much. So, yeah, pretty simple definition.
And most of the still water you fish up in the Northwest is for trout primarily, right?
Yes, yeah, and to some degree bass, but not all that often, but I'm certainly not going to pass on an opportunity. But pretty much trout, and up here it's real common that we'll have any of rainbow cutthroat, browns, brookies, and then a few other kind of strains and hybrid forms and so forth.
Okay. Now, in your book, I know you were talking about lowland water versus probably higher altitude, mm-hmm. mid-altitude waters. What do you find different among those waters or and how you approach them?
Sure. My basic approach is most of the time the same or very similar. And what I'll end up doing in either case is I'll simply let the fish tell me how I'm going to tailor my approach that day. And if I'm going in blind and I don't have a lot of recent experience there or intel, if you will, I might go in, fish it blind, but I'm going to start out using very similar methods. And unless there's a reason for me to fish on top of the water, usually I'll go in and type 5 full sink line is usually my first weapon of choice just because they tend to be really versatile, and the density compensated ones that are out there in use today are make them really user friendly. For me, at least, I have a pretty easy time casting them, and I can fish a good range of depths and so forth with them. So the only time starting out that I'll usually go to a bit slower line is in a really shallow pond situation where I know I'm just going to be dragging weeds and it's kind of not worth the effort. But usually that's kind of how I'll start out in an approach. And then, yeah, pretty much from there, I'll let them tell me as far as where the strikes and how they're coming and so forth.
So what do you, and again, in your book, you spent quite a bit of time mm-hmm. talking about scouting out your mm-hmm. still waters and what you look for and how you analyze and so forth. So,
sure.
So you can share some of your tips about how you do that in looking at the water that you plan to fish.
Sure. And again, if we're talking about lowland lakes versus higher altitude or more secluded lakes, in that way, I'll start to use some different methods of finding good water to fish. So even though the methods I use might be pretty similar in either case, what I'm going to look for could be a bit different. But the way I'll approach lowland lakes is I'm a bit more subjective that way. So I'll go with just my own priorities, things that I like to have in the environment that I fish in. So I may look at more things like, okay, do I like an area that's kind of, do I mind if it's more crowded, less crowded? Is there a certain species of fish that I am more kind of, that I like to find more? So like in my case, I love to fish for brown trout. So I'm going to look for lakes around here that have browns because we have less of them. So you kind of have to seek those out. Other things, even simple things like accessibility, distance from home, a lot of that type of thing. But I'm more concerned about, if it's reasonably fishable, I'm not going to get too picky as far as, okay, well, this is a great so-called lowland lake versus a little bit more difficult one. And certainly things like whether you have standard regulations and so forth, or is it a catch and release situation? And certainly there's going to be a big difference there. We don't have, in my opinion, and you're going to find that throughout most of the local fly fishing community in Western Washington, is that we really don't have enough catch and release lakes up here. We have I can name a handful of them, but very small fraction of what you find out there. So availability of that's going to be limited, but certainly they fish noticeably better, and the way that they act most of the year makes a really strong case for wanting to find water like that. But other than that, I'm probably going to go with some pretty just subjective things and to suit my own preferences versus higher altitude or more secluded lakes. And then I'm going to get more specific about what I'm looking for, because in a lot of cases, if you're going to make the time and effort to seek these places out and to get yourself up there and so forth, you want something that's going to kind of have some reward and some return to it by the time you get there. And so there are some things that I've found are pretty consistent among the ones that produce for me. And some of those are that elevation-wise, I tend to gravitate more toward mid-elevation in terms of, you know, how fertile and how conducive the environment is to the fish there, how well they do and so forth. I find that they tend to be a little healthier, and it's a little easier to find lakes that are going to be productive, kind of in that 1,000 to 2,000 foot range in the area that I live in versus going way up, more kind of 4,000 or 5,000 feet. I think it gets a lot more challenging then to find good productive lakes and to find bigger fish and so forth. So I'll look for that. And, of course, the time that it takes to get to them dictates how often you can go, how much time you can spend on them, and that's going to have some to do as well with the kind of success that you're going to have, because in a lot of cases, you're just going to need to go up and be able to spend some time on these, and when you can't get to them very often, or it's more of a once or twice a year thing, then it's just a roll of the dice, and you have really high odds of kind of striking out when you go. Other things that I'll look for, generally the smaller size, which tends to be common once you get out into a little bit upper elevation and so forth. So I tend to look for generally under 20 acres, but a lot of what I'm finding might even be, you know, 8 acres, 5 acres, even just an acre or two. And of course, it's a lot easier to cover the surface area and to fish it high and low and be able to get a good sampling of what's in there. Some that are really important that I look for, I actually, if it's a situation where the lake or the pond is stocked, I look for actually a lower stocking count versus greater numbers, just because once you get out in places that are less populated and less pressured, you actually have more odds of overpopulation in those lakes, and so you may not have an issue catching fish, but catching anything of size, even over 8 or 9 inches, might be impossible, and that might be all that's in there in some cases.
Right.
So the lesser those numbers, actually the better off you might be, and they tend to grow bigger and thrive more and things like that. So a last one that I'll mention is when you're in a smaller lake environment, it's a lot easier to see if there are any pressure signs and if somebody's handing it some abuse. So, you know, I look for even garbage. Is it stuff? Can I tell? Is it what fishermen are leaving behind? You know, do you find a lot of the usual kind of, you know, wasted fishing line, bobbers in the trees, that sort of thing? And if you can see that it's taken some abuse, I mean, even by very few people, that can have a big impact on a smaller lake. But those are some of the things that I'll look for.
Do you check with the state as to, for instance, when they last stocked it or if they're stocking it, or do any research that way before you go out?
Absolutely.
Fish are in there.
Yeah. Yep. And so I use really simple resources, and there's a whole lot of information out there. In my state, it's as simple as going on to Fish and Wildlife's website, and all that information is laid out. And in some cases, I actually track that year to year, and I kind of build my own spreadsheets and so forth, so I can kind of look at it over time, and it makes it easier to see over a period of years what's gone on. But yeah, certainly, I use that information a whole lot, and I've started to kind of correlate, like you say, how often a place is getting stocked and the numbers that are going in and things like that. And surprisingly, I find that the less often and the smaller the stocks, the better a lake tends to do, particularly these smaller ones. And it's surprising the size of the exactly, and it's surprising the size of the fish that you'll find in these places. And just to kind of sort of tip off there, once you have fish that are 4 or 5 years old, if they've survived that long and they're still going, they tend to get really interesting after, you know, that length of time.
Yeah. So, that's what I've heard in the past is, you know, if you get a little less competition in there, then the fish will grow larger. Otherwise, they all kind of like the idea of putting one fish in a large tank, and as the 20 fish in a large tank, you know, then
exactly.
None of them really go pretty big. Yeah.
Exactly.
I think I had heard something, analogy, something like that recently about koi.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll grow to the actual size of their environment, and if the environment's restrictive, they don't grow. And so, I guess that happens in the wild, too.
Yeah, and you find something really similar. Yeah, I was just going to make the point, too, that these fish, when they do make it and they grow really large in a small pond environment, I don't find that they're any more difficult to catch than the smaller fish, and that's kind of interesting to know. So it just becomes a matter of being able to find them and pinpoint these places where they're going to be, and if you can get that far, they're definitely not difficult at all to go and lure up, and to, they're just as easy as anything else to catch.
Okay. Dennis in Lakeside, Arizona asked about what's your opinion on atmospheric pressure and moon phases, and how, you know, does that affect trout fishing, or does it affect when you go out?
That's a good one. For me, actually, I don't pay a whole lot of attention to it, but I'm certainly not going to sit and say that it has no effect. And whether it has a direct effect or if it affects things, intermediary things that in turn affect the fishing, like if it's the food sources or something to that effect, certainly. But I won't go so far as to say that I track those things and I kind of time my outings by it or anything like that. But if, yeah, certainly if those are a factor, I would look at that as, you know, one thing among a whole slew of other factors that are going to affect how the action is and, you know, whether it's worth going or that type of thing.
Yeah, yeah. Let's talk about equipment for a little bit. Howard in mm-hmm. Camp Springs, Maryland. He says, what basic gear do you need to get started? You know, like mm-hmm. what size rod and reel do you use? That kind of thing for stillwater fishing.
Okay, sure. And I like questions like this, and anything that kind of, if you're getting started into it particularly and you kind of want an idea of what you have to have versus, you know, what's kind of nice to have and so forth, I always make the point that you really don't have to go into anything really expensive or really fancy or gear up a whole lot and empty your bank account if you want to get started at this stuff, because there's certainly nothing wrong with that, but in my experience, I mean, you and I might care, but the fish are going to care a lot less. And in fact, I go so far as to say they really don't care at all, but I tend to go middle of the road. So in the places that I fish, most of the time I'm using the same rod, and it's just a simple 5-weight, 9-foot, medium fast action rod. I didn't spend a whole lot on it. In my case, I think the one I'm using now is around 225, 230, so not what you'd consider upper end or anything like that, but at least in what I've seen, once you kind of hit that 150 threshold price tag wise, you're pretty much there, or I would say you're probably 80% of the way there, and the way that it functions, you're probably, especially as a newer fly fisher, you're not going to be able to tell a big difference between how that one acts versus a rod that maybe you spent $500 or $600 on. And I'm even less particular about the reel. So it's kind of the same point. If you really enjoy a reel that performs really well and has a certain feel to it and it's something that costs more, by all means do it. In my case, the one I'm using, it's still the old Orvis Bat and Kill. I think they discontinued that one, but I have several of them and lots of spools and kind of no reason to go off that. But I know there's certainly a lot better out there, but I can tell you absolute sure that, you know, it certainly doesn't put any limits on, you know, how I'm doing on the water or anything like that. So
right.
Certainly if you go simple and if you want to go on the cheap, it's not going to hurt you.
Okay. Tim, we need to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll talk more. I want to get into talking more about, you had already talked a little bit about fly lines, but I want to talk more about fly lines. So
okay.
Just a few seconds, and we'll be right back. Keeney's Fly Shop in Sacramento, California features classes on all aspects of fly fishing. They have an extensive inventory and fly tying department and a friendly, experienced staff whose primary goal is your complete satisfaction. Among their many services, one can book private waters or take advantage of their international travel service. Visit their extensive website at www.keeney.com. That's K-I-E-N-E.com. Or call Keeney's Fly Shop at 1-800-400-0359. That's 1-800-400-0359. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Tim Lockhart about stillwater strategies. If you'd like to ask Tim a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. So, Tim, I always ask my guests at this point in the show, you know, what's going on in your fly fishing world? So what have you been up to?
Sure. Well, I had a whole lot of thoughts and ideas about starting a second book, which honestly I haven't done yet, and I think that was probably smart. When I first did this book, and of course it's the first one I've ever done, I had no idea what I was signing up for in terms of, once the book is released, sort of what that's going to bring on in terms of going out and speaking to local fly clubs and other organizations or similar, book signings, all that sort of things, radio appearances. No, this is my first, actually. But just all that sort of thing. I sort of had no idea. So I've been spending time doing that and kind of learning how to get a little bit better on the speaking side of it, and that's kind of a new thing for me. So just kind of honing my skills there and really just having a whole lot of fun doing all that type of stuff. So I've really enjoyed it so far. And whether I start another book or when that happens, I'm not too sure yet, but I'm rather enjoying sort of what this one has brought on and kind of all the friends I've made and the folks I've met as a result and so forth. So it's been a good year that way so far, and the book's just been out since January here.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, so it is brand new. Yeah, great. Well, wish you all the luck with that, and hopefully we'll see another one out of you sometime in the future, and let us know when that happens.
All right, thanks.
We've got to dig into some fly lines here. Paul in Moscow, Idaho says, what do you think is the best overall type of fly line for lake fishing? And I think you just said before that you start out with a sinking line, usually. But tell us a bit about the different lines that you might use.
Okay, sure. And Paul in Moscow, I have family out there, and so likely we know some of the same people, given the size town it is, if you've been there for a while. So anyway, so back to the question here. I use probably, and I think it mentions in the book, 90%+ of the time I'm using the same simple sinking line out there, which is just that type 5 full sink. And half of that has to do with the lakes that I'm fishing in. It tends to work really well. I'm not going much beyond 20 feet of depth most of the time, and a lot of places that I go, the lakes don't get much deeper than that. So I tend to be able to get, if I'm wanting to go down into the deeper parts of the lake or toward the floor of the lake, it goes there easily and quickly and so forth. And so it's a nice versatile line. And I think I've just gotten so used to using that particular one and have had success on it. It's kind of like the more time goes by and the better I do with it, I just keep going to it more and more and that type of thing. So yeah, definitely something that's versatile in that way. And then, beyond that, most of the time, if I'm not using that one, I'm using a floater in the places that I'm in. And I do go in between the two extremes there, but yeah, not very often. But again, it's just, I'm just going with what's working and kind of what suits the areas that I'm fishing in, really.
So you don't use intermediate sinking line much?
Very little. So in some cases, if for some reason I want to be up really high and I don't want to use a floater, I want to get it beneath the surface, or maybe I'm stripping, for example, and I don't want to be causing action on the surface or disturbance on the surface with a floater, I'll go with an intermediate. Or in a situation of really shallow water, if I just know I'm going to be hanging it up in the weeds or something like that, and I know I'm not going to go much lower than, just a few feet or even 3 or 4 feet or that type of thing, I have a type 2 that I'll use. But admittedly, it's not all that often. Most of the time, I'll go straight to a type 5. And I would say in most cases, with guys that I'm talking to out on the water as well, usually the problem they're having is they're not getting down deep enough or they're not getting down fast enough. And a lot of them are using either a floating line when they should be using a sinker, or they're not counting down long enough. And so I usually encourage a little bit faster sinking line just to try and get them down a little deeper. And most of the time, if there are fish present and you're not getting into them in a lake situation, it's really common, particularly among less experienced fly fishers, that you're simply fishing too high up in the water column, or you're above them and you just need to get down a few feet further. So that's why I always really advocate those faster sinking lines.
Okay. Greg Simpson in Rapid City wanted to know about, says, do you use fly lines that are more neutral in color,
mm-hmm.
or do you care about color?
Sure, and if I told you I did, I'd be lying to you there. It's kind of like my approach to flies, and it'll probably fly in the face of what a lot of guys practice and believe in, but I always say that I haven't met a color that I didn't like, or I haven't run across a bad color, but I know of a lot of good ones, and that kind of holds with flies and fly lines. But at least in my experience, I haven't had an issue because I was using a color that was maybe spooking the fish or something like that. And again, that might speak more loudly to the areas that I'm fishing in and the situations that I'm fishing in and where I tend to be able to get in front of fish and find them. But they tend not to be really picky about things like that. So that's why I haven't spent a whole lot of time experimenting and you know, looking for or using, like, I know a lot of guys are getting into, like, the clear camo types and some of the other stuff where there's a bit more of a way to kind of hide what's going on or be subtle to the fish and that sort of thing. But I honestly haven't found a whole lot of situations where I'm wanting to experiment with that a whole lot.
Now, and probably one of the things about that is if the fish are seeing your line, they're already spooked. Probably doesn't matter what color it is. You know, if you're lining over the fish or that kind of thing, then they're already damaged goods.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, a good example of that is where, let's say, if you're seeing action on the surface or very close to the surface and you're even kind of out there spot fishing and you go over the top of them because you're going to drag your fly back over them. That's exactly kind of what you're talking about there. Is sometimes even when the fly line lands, you know, you can even see them take off on you.
Well, and I'm sure, and we may talk about this more later, but I have a small, just a couple acre lake down here that I fish quite a bit. And, you know, especially towards dusk, most of the fish are near the edge. And if you're throwing out from, you know, you're just scaring away, you know, some of the bigger fish because they're right up close to the bank as it gets, mm-hmm. you know, darker. So, you know, a lot of times, and I think almost everybody we talk to say, hey, the biggest mistake fly fishers make is wading into the water and not fishing it before they, you know, wade into it. And I think the same thing applies to lakes probably.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I've even met guys, particularly what little fishing I did over in the UK, who will back up from the edge of the water and then kneel down and cast from a kneeling position. And they're really particular about that first few feet, you know, beyond the bank there and what lays there and so forth. And from what I observed, they're right. And I never got very good at it, but yeah, it certainly seems to pay off.
Right. What about, now you primarily, and I know we have some questions on chronomid fishing here, but that's... Mm-hmm. really not your forte, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
You do a lot of your fishing underwater, as you've already indicated, if you're using full sinking line, you know,
mm-hmm.
70-80% of the time. So what, in those situations of fishing under the water, what kind of leader and tippet setups do you use for that type of fishing?
Sure. And I'm probably not the most useful guy to put a lot of specific information out there for guys to kind of hone their skills in it and so forth. So I do very little of it, and usually when I do, I'm with guys that kind of do it religiously and joining them and kind of learning their techniques and so forth. So I certainly don't do anything very sophisticated, and I haven't gone down real deep. Some of these guys can do 20 plus feet a leader and manage that and everything, and admittedly, I'm not that coordinated yet to be able to do that. So usually when I'm doing it, I'm probably in 10 feet of water or less, or I'm certainly not fishing much deeper in that. So I haven't had to get too specific about sort of the equipment I'm using and so forth. So, you know, usually for an indicator for me, since I don't...
Oh, no, I was talking probably... I was talking
okay,
more
I'm
about
sorry.
Leader and tippet setups for your... when you're using your full sinking line.
Oh, I'm sorry. Get off track. That's a lot easier. Actually, and when I'm going down with a full sink... I tend to use the fluorocarbon, kind of the shorter, tapered leaders, so usually I'm going 6 foot there. And in the situations that I fish in, I go a little bit heavy, so I'll do something that's usually 2X, kind of around there, and go to a tippet that's 3X. Some of that has to do with what you might hang up on if you're fishing deep and you have a little bit better odds of freeing it up. Some of it has to do with the places that I'm fishing, that it's common you'll hit something pretty good and you're going to want that kind of line strength. And then a third thing I would say is, particularly fishing down at depth, at least in my experience, they tend not to be all of that picky or get spooked by, you know, leader and tippet that's going to be too thick or something like that. I haven't found that to be the case. So usually I think the downside of using something that's too thin or not enough strength probably outweighs whatever kind of stealth you're going to get out of a heavier setup. But, you know, that said, that's kind of my own sort of particular thing, and I think I more do it out of habit. So if you're a guy who's just going to go down with a few feet of mono and, you know, nothing all that sophisticated, I doubt you're going to do any worse, you know, using that method or something like that. So I think there's a lot of wiggle room once you're down at depth.
Okay. Okay. What about, do you do more of your fishing from boats, float tubes, pontoon boats, or from the shore? Where do you find yourself?
Sure. I am, anybody local here that knows me, I even get made fun of because I still use the old school round style float tube, which I don't even know if you can find those anymore, or at least it's getting less and less being able to actually go out and buy one if you're going to do it new. But the reason I do that,
the federal government, Tim, the federal government banned float tubes.
I know that would probably,
you'll probably get arrested.
Yeah, exactly. I think I'd have to relearn the sport, but it's true. I use one almost exclusively, and I've gotten too used to it, and I still fit in the dumb thing, and so that's part of it too. They tend not to allow a guy much beyond, let's say, 220 or so. So I know that rules a lot of us out, and that almost rules me out. But in my case, just because it's so easy to transport, half the time I'm hiking with it, and so I even leave it inflated, and I'll either just hoist it over a shoulder, or I have pack straps for it. But it's just really versatile, easy to get around. I think the thing weighs 5 pounds with no gear on it, so they're just really easy that way. And then the only thing where I really lose on it is, of course, if I'm going to need to go fast in it, it's not going to happen. So it's really great to fish out of. They're great in the wind, and they're great to maneuver in and things like that if you're used to them. I'm not going to say it's the most comfortable thing in the world to be in, but it's not horrible, and you kind of get used to them. So that's a little bit unique about me, and I certainly wouldn't advocate for the masses out there that, yeah, you should use a round float tube, because I might be the last guy on Earth doing it. So that's part of it, too.
I still have one, Tim.
I don't know if you can find it anymore, but, yeah, I think a lot of us still have them in the garage somewhere.
Yeah, I know a lot of people, I think, like, you know, using the pontoons now because, you know, you sit up higher.
Mm-hmm.
Out better, not so low to the water. So I guess that's one of the advantages.
Yeah, and admittedly, most of the guys I'm seeing around here are doing pontoons, you know, by and large. Yeah, and a lot of guys are doing prams in the lakes around here just because chronomid fishing is so common, and that's a great way to sit and do that and that type of thing. But yeah, when it comes down to float tubes, people are certainly using something a bit more sophisticated, usually the V design with a much more comfortable chair, and even those sit a lot higher. I'm probably the lowest thing in the water in terms of kind of where I'm sitting and so forth.
Right. Well, Paul in Los Osos, California, mm-hmm. He says he's new to float tubing and wondering two things. Is an anchor useful? If so, how do you use it?
Mm-hmm.
He's got a second part to his question. Why don't you address that?
Okay, sure. And I like these questions. I don't use an anchor myself, and part of that is just because being in that round tube, it's really easy to control just with your feet. And if you want to hold a position, you know, even in a little bit rough conditions or something like that, it's a lot easier to do that, actually, just with your feet than it is to manage an anchor and go up and down and that type of thing. I haven't seen in a lot of cases, at least in my area, where guys are using them. Usually in most cases, they're in something a bit bigger. Some of the pontoons, and certainly the guys out there in the prams and the rowboats and things like that are doing it. But I haven't seen that it's a real common thing that people do. So unless you have like a really, either a real specific reason to do it, or if you're going with friends and they've got a method really dialing in and they're anchoring up out of float tubes, then certainly join them and do it. But I wouldn't say it's a real common thing that a lot of guys are doing.
Here's another second part of his question was, do you use any kind of fish finder?
Yeah, and that's an interesting one. I don't myself. I certainly don't discourage it. Probably a good guess is that half the guys that I observe and half the guys that I know are using them. For me, in my case, I have a little bit better luck just searching with the fly and going down and just seeing what they react to versus, you know, marking fish on a fish finder. And boy, a lot of the times when I see guys out there using them, they're marking fish and they're seeing them, but they're not necessarily drawing any strikes. And you see that all the time. Guys will just get in a quandary. It's like, man, they're right there. They're 10 feet below me, and there's a lot of them, or I'm seeing big fish. But there's this big disconnect between marking them and then being able to actually draw their attention or draw the strike. So usually I'll fish blind, and I'll let the fly and let their reaction to the fly tell me if I'm in a good spot and if I'm using a good method and that sort of thing. And the obvious drawback being I can't sit there and tell you at any specific time, oh, yeah, they're right there, unless there's something visible where I'm going to see, you know, if they're having activity on the surface or something like that. But, boy, a lot of the times you're just going to know that they're there either by the reaction you get or by the clues that you have visible to you and that type of thing. You can give yourself pretty darn good odds.
Yeah, yeah. What other equipment do you find useful when you're out in the tube that you recommend people take with them?
Well, something that's a little bit maybe some people might consider obscure, or is it actually fishing equipment, but the most probably what has simply gotten me more fish than anything else I use, believe it or not, is just my watch. Because I'm a big believer in time management and using that to your advantage. And there's a whole lot of little tricks you can do with that that are going to help you out and actually equate to more fish in your net. But in my case, I tend to time even things like if I'm not having success and I'm using a certain method, I'll time it, and I'll only give myself so long for something to work. And so instead of sticking with something for an hour or more, or even a half an hour, a lot of times 10, 15 minutes is all you need to give something, or 20 minutes or something like that. But we tend to really lose track of how much time is going by, and particularly when we're not being successful. That can really hurt you at the end of the day, because there might be a lot of opportunity out there, and you're simply not changing methods, changing depth, changing approach, or changing the area that you're fishing in, or anything like that. So I tend to pay really close attention to how long I'm taking to everything. And if I'm not drawing a strike for a certain period of time, usually for me, 15 minutes, it starts to bother me if there's no strikes going on. And that's kind of in general terms. If you're out there and you know it's just a dead part of the day, then of course that's going to be different. But when you know it's fishing reasonably well and that there's action to be had, I don't like to go any longer than that without trying something different or relocating or something like that. But that's kind of an example of it.
Like 15 minutes, you said, is an average time you give a certain technique?
Usually, yeah. After 15 minutes, or at least I'll start to think, okay, am I in the wrong area? Am I at the wrong depth? And am I using the wrong method, or that type of thing? But kind of the overall point being,
something up.
Yeah, that's it. So you don't want to waste 2 hours if you otherwise could have found fish and gotten into the swing of things and stuff like that, because a day can go by really, really fast. So I tend to pay attention to all those things. And if I am having success, I'm also going to time even the interval between strikes that I'm getting, that type of thing, and do kind of a hot-cold thing as far as where I'm relocating, how I'm casting, and that sort of thing. Or something like I'll pay attention to parts of the day, and if it's slow for a period of time in the morning, I'll start to watch, okay, if that's happening, if I'm 2 hours into a slow period, if I'm 4 hours into a slow period, because a lot of times, particularly if I'm familiar with the lake I'm fishing in, that's going to tell me when the action's going to come back on, and it might also tell me kind of how hot the action's going to get. And if it's a long time and slow periods going on and it's really dead and I'm not seeing anything, chances are when it turns on, it's going to turn on hard. And so I'll just pay attention to all those little things. But usually something like that and just putting yourself on the best parts of the day, the most active parts of the day in the location you should be in is going to get you a whole lot more success than worrying about, okay, what fly am I using? Am I using the right equipment? That type of thing. But yeah, that's kind of why I'll prioritize that first. But yeah,
Do you do much journaling on the water, making notes, or is this all kind of in your head, especially when you're fishing a lake again and again?
That's a good question, too. To some degree, I do. I don't keep a log constantly. I think what can happen if you journal too much is that you'll start to go by what you think is going to happen, and you'll stick to a plan, and it might be to the point that you're going to miss things that are going on right in front of you because you're so kind of drilled onto what you think is going to happen that day. So I tend to go somewhat by the seat of my pants because I want to be open and available to whatever's going to happen in front of me and to be able to react to it and interpret it and so forth. So I only like to go with a plan or something that I've written down in the past to the extent that it kind of gives me a start and a direction to go when I don't otherwise have one. But I would say in my case, I certainly put more time and more stock into improvisation and reacting to what's going on in a particular day. But yeah, I would not discourage keeping a log, especially earlier on. And I would say for me that I was doing that a lot more earlier on, or if I'm not as experienced on a particular body of water or something like that, then I'm going to take more notes at first. Yeah, for sure.
No. Okay, let's take a quick break, and when we come back, let's talk about food and flies and dig into that a bit. So a minute and I'll be right back. Grow Gorge Anglers is a full-service fly shop on the Arkansas River in Canyon City, Colorado. They provide both walkweight and float fishing guide service on the Arkansas South Platte and several high country ranches. They specialize in fly fishing education and work to assure that everyone taking a trip leaves being a better fly fisher. For the best service and the most fun in the Southern Rockies, visit the folks at Grow Gorge Anglers, the gateway to Southern Colorado. Located conveniently on U.S. 50, only 45 minutes from Colorado Springs. For more information, visit their website at www.royalgorgeanglers.com. That's www.royalgorgeanglers.com. Or call them at 888-994-6743. That's 888-994-6743. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Tim Lockhart about stillwater strategies. If you'd like to ask Tim a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. Receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many as possible on the show tonight. So, let's see. I'm looking at some of them. We've got a few questions coming in here, and I think we'll hold off on these for just a couple more minutes and mix them in when we're talking about strategies and tactics here. So, let's dig into food and flies. So, what are the primary food sources that you feel as fly fishers we need to be concerned with in still waters and be prepared for in the way of flies and so forth?
That's a great question. And, of course, the answer that I'm going to come up with might speak more toward the area that I'm fishing in. So certainly for those in other areas that encounter other things that are more prevalent and so forth, I certainly acknowledge that. But kind of general all around for where I am and I think, you know, where you're going to encounter in most other areas, my short list would be midges, mayflies, minnows, damsels, and daphnia. And I tend to have had good success kind of tracking those and following those in the areas where I've been fishing in. Midges, of course, having those just about year-round, and they tend to be going on to some degree most of the year, and probably most of the fish that I take in the year, if you're going to attribute something that they're feeding on, it's going to be that, which is kind of interesting since I don't do much or any vertical chronomid presentation. But the nice thing that I found with those is that the fish tend to be less picky in terms of the exact method you're using, the presentation. So you can kind of wing it there. And if they're down taking chronomids at some certain depth, you can certainly go in with a different type of presentation and something that maybe doesn't so much match what they're feeding on and draw a reaction from them. So I really like fishing midge hatches and chronomid activity. Mayflies are probably my favorite only because you can get a lot of action right at the surface. So using a dry fly presentation or an emerger or something where you're going to see the strike. And I would say about lake fishing that at least the places that I go that you don't see it often enough. So I always love to take advantage of that. And usually in the areas where I am, it's Calabatus hatch, and it's right about this time of year. So I always try and plan my schedule around that. And if there's any time of the year where I'm going to sneak out of work, it's probably going to be in the spring when that's happening. So I always look for that. Minnows, that's another one that's really common most of the year in the places where I fish. And that probably brings the second most action that I find, just because it's really prevalent in the places where I fish. There tends to be a lot of them, and they can come in, and when they're up in close to shore or above the weed beds or something like that, there's just a whole lot of activity and a lot of opportunity where you can take fish around them and stuff. And so that can be really exciting, and you'll actually see a lot of surface activity. And even though you might be fishing underneath the surface, it's not hard to find the action and to get dialed into it and so forth. So that's certainly another favorite, and I mentioned, the other two I mentioned, Damsels and Daphnia, kind of the same thing. Each of those is unique and can be a lot of fun to get to know those food sources, and Damsels just because of when they occur during the summer. And you can find a lot of times when you aren't going to find a lot of guys wanting to go out there in midday conditions and direct bright sunlight, and you think there's going to be nothing going on and the water's too warm and the fish are going to be hunkered down. So you might be in an area either by yourself or with not many guys out there, and all of a sudden you've got all this activity because the food source is there and you see a lot going on like near the shorelines and so forth, and you find a lot of opportunity with something like that, and you can have a heck of a lot of fun with it. So sometimes just the timing of it with some of these food sources can be a lot of fun, and you might find yourself out there having something really good to yourself. And Daphnia, kind of the same thing, and those can be a little bit tougher to track the activity and to dial into the action, and they're kind of unique in their own way too, because you don't really imitate those. And what I've found, it's kind of even more extreme than chronomid situation, is that you go with something just completely different because they're just too small and there are too many of them to really want to get in and try and do some kind of, I don't even know if I could do a successful imitation there. I'm not that skilled, so I'll take the biggest pattern I can and drag it through the middle of them, kind of oversimplify it there, but the fish tend to react to it, and it's usually more a matter of just finding where that's happening and getting into the middle of feeding fish and so forth. So those are some of my favorites.
Yeah. We did have a specific question on that that came in on the Internet. James in Victoria says, we often have fish in 50 feet of water that are feeding on Daphnia in the middle of the water column. So I guess that's 25 feet under or something is what he says. And what flies should you try, and how do you present them? So he wants you to
Daphnia approach. Okay. Yeah, I can do that. At least mention what I use and so forth. And I usually see, in terms of where they locate, where the I'll call them clouds of this food or Daphnia, where they locate, is either in what you're describing, or at times what I found when the lighting gets a bit lower toward the evening or into the night, it can actually come up and move shallower and toward the shoreline, and so you'll find a lot different situation, which can be a whole lot of fun. And I've even seen where the fish will get a lot less bashful, and they'll feed on this stuff really high up and really close to shore, and you'll actually see the activity. You'll see them rolling near the shoreline and things like that, and they tend really not to be picky about the presentation you're using or anything like that. But myself, in that situation, I'll stay with the same line, so I'll use a sinking, full sink line, type 5 in my case, and I'll go down. I actually won't change off of kind of my go-to fly, and in my case, it's another thing I sort of get made fun of because I use it so often, but I love leech patterns, and the one that I tend to gravitate toward is called a beadhead semi-seal leech, and it's probably mentioned a bunch of times in the book if I remember. But I'll just go down with something like that. But seriously, in James's case, if he has another favorite, a dragonfly pattern he likes to search with, or a minnow, or anything like that, in those cases, don't be afraid to go to something kind of oversized and go down and be a bit aggressive with your approach and so forth, because I've found that the way they're moving on this food and feeding on it and so forth, I think they're making a lot of effort to get a little bit of food, and so they're moving a lot. So you put something like that, it's really going to get noticed from what I found, and it's going to get chased down a lot. And they're probably not going to be very bashful at it in those cases. It's just a matter more of getting yourself located where the fish are going to be active on this stuff.
So you don't even try to match it or come close. You just go totally opposite and try to attract them. Yeah.
This particular one, it's probably the most extreme case of that, and at least most of what you read other guys saying out there that have written about it, from what I've found, is they tend to go opposite, and this is a really good one for that. But there's just, when you see it out there, or even looking at pictures of what it looks like and so forth, I couldn't even tell you how to come up with a match on something like that, or logically in my mind, I can't think of, if you were able to actually do that, what were your odds of drawing a strike on it? I would just think that in this particular case that, going opposite, getting something big down there and getting it noticed, and the type of, if you want to call it, the type of mood that they're in and the way they're behaving, I think they're going to jump on it.
Okay. So what are, you mentioned beadhead semi-seal leech, which kind of looks to me like a little sparser tie, but like Denny Rickards has a seal booger, I think, and tied with seal fur, I'm assuming. This one's tied with seal fur, too.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a material you like for lake fishing? I know a lot of people like it because of it's lively. It looks alive. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, for that, and then, well, it's kind of, I'm a little bit different in terms of my preferences and the types of flies that I'll choose and why I choose them and so forth. And, you know, certainly appearance is part of it, but I also look at things like, let's say, how it casts, how it, you know, the weight of it with the line that I'm using. Does it work well that way? Am I going to hang it up a lot? Is it, you know, a good practical choice? That type of thing. Yeah, how does it move? How does it sink? A lot of those types of things. I'm usually less concerned about, okay, does it exactly imitate some certain thing in the water or that type of thing. I tend to go with really practical reasons for selecting a fly. I'm less concerned about colors and things like that than probably most guys are. And I tend to be one of those people who just looks for kind of a more abstract sort of a match. So another example, like fishing dry flies or something, I'll probably not look to exactly imitate something that's going on or get really picky about that. I'm thinking more in terms of, okay, am I too big? Am I too small? Is the profile on the water something that's drawing them or turning them away? That type of thing. So I tend not to get kind of too specific about imitation and so forth. It's more just kind of general and practical and that type of thing.
Scott in Reno, Nevada asked about, do you think a dragonfly nymph is a productive pattern? Is that something you use?
I like that question too. Not that often, but I would say absolutely yes, because I can't really tell you why, for instance, I prefer a semi-sill leech versus a dragonfly pattern, because I honestly believe I do equally well on either one of them. I think I just got fixed on the leech and had some good success with it. And kind of another thing that may be a little bit abstract, but I'm a firm believer in, is if you start to believe in a certain pattern and for no logical reason, but you've had some success with it and you're really confident in it, you know, I'd say by all means keep fishing it. And if you feel good about it, that might actually have a lot more to do with the success that you have versus, you know, finding the best match out there or something like that. Because I really think that if you're less confident in a pattern or you're kind of unsure about it or you don't believe in it, you're going to fish it differently. And I think the way you're going to work it in the water and what it's going to appear like and what your hands are doing and that type of thing, I think your level of confidence in what's going on in your head is going to directly translate to how it appears and how it presents in the water and so forth. But yeah, dragonfly nymph, a lot of guys love to search with minnow patterns, different things like that. But yeah, for me it has more to do with the confidence that you have in it. But yeah, I would say certainly if you gave me that and told me to fish it and go search with it and so forth, I think I would do equally well on it.
What do you have in your box? What are your go-to flies? What do you don't leave home without?
Myself, so I tend to take, you probably kind of gotten onto this by now, I take a less is more approach. So over time, I have found that kind of the less and less that I drill down to, the better I tend to do by simplifying and not having a big selection to kind of worry about and get stuck in, okay, am I using the right pattern or maybe I should go to something different, because it's forcing me to try and to look at other things that are probably more important as far as how I'm actually going to draw fish. But the ones that I'm kind of gravitating to these days, beyond the leech pattern, I always keep hare's ear nymphs on me, like just simple gold rib hare's ear. In my case, size 12, size 14, 16, kind of in that range. 14 a lot, actually, the places that I'm fishing. But that seems to be a good general purpose fly, and especially if I'm going to look for something just under the surface and I'm seeing some activity and they're not quite taking on the surface, but I can see they're close. Usually something like that. And if I haven't exactly dialed into why they're there or why they're behaving a certain way, that one seems to be a good general all around. And again, it might have something to do with my confidence in it. So it's one that I've used for a long time. A mayfly emerger, usually again a size 14 if I'm going to fish right on the surface. I usually keep a good stock of those in my box. And, you know, beyond that, there's a couple more that I'll use commonly, but I mean, really, I could get by most of the year on three or four patterns in the places where I'm fishing. And it usually, if I'm going to something more than that, and again, I have a few other favorites, but you know, it's probably more personal preference, or if somehow I'm kind of lacking confidence on what I'm using and I'm really out of ideas and nothing else is working, then okay, you know, kind of as a last resort, I'll start switching flies out and looking. But it's not real often.
Yeah, pretty simple approach. Yeah. So let's talk about, there was one more question, and then we'll mm-hmm. talk more about strategies and tactics here. Peter in Edmonton, Alberta, asked about, does the ability of trout to see light in ultraviolet spectrum affect the design and choice of your fly patterns for still waters?
You know, in my case, I would say not so much. I mean, I certainly consider the amount of visibility and the amount of light coming into the water and everything as far as the approach that I'm going to take, but probably I'm going to think in terms of maybe the size of the pattern, smaller versus bigger, that type of thing. And if I think they're going to be more spooky because the visibility is a lot higher in the water, whether that's, you know, direct sunlight coming in or the surface, there's no wind on the surface and so it's smooth, different things like that, then I'm going to start to consider, you know, a few things. And I know not just the fly, the approach that I'm taking and, you know, whatever is going to spook fish and that type of thing. But fly pattern, yeah, I won't really go into it as far as, you know, different materials and you know, different colors or that type of thing where, you know,
okay.
I'm thinking it's,
yeah.
So I don't want to say that it's something that, oh, yeah, I give that a lot of consideration and it has a lot to do with success for me, because in my case, not so much.
Yeah, it sounds like from what I've learned from you so far is that mm-hmm. it's more about getting whatever you've got in the right place is more important than what it is. So,
certainly.
In fact, that kind of segues into the next section. Mike Clark was from New York was asking about what is a typical approach to stillwater fishing. And so I thought I'd mm-hmm. kind of segue into your when, where, how, and what approach. And I'll let you explain that, but folks, what is the last
yes.
thing. So go ahead and explain your philosophy there.
Certainly, and I'll kind of preempt that by saying that you could talk to 20 different guys with 20 different methods to this and approaches to stillwater fly fishing, and they could all be right. So I'm going to claim that mine is one of many possibilities, and I know other stuff out there, other approaches certainly work, and you kind of have to go with what works for you. And so these are the things that I've found to really help me, and I've had really good success with. So, you know, for a guy starting out to be able to kind of put some of these methods and approaches to work and so forth, I know it works, and I think that it's stuff where anyone can pick it up and use it. And that's kind of the good part about the way I go about it, is it's based on simplicity, and I certainly don't claim to know any rocket science. I'm not that good. I'm not that sophisticated at it. So I tend to, I actually seek out more simple methods for finding success on the water. And it's a great thing because it's something you can teach to other people and have people pick up on. And, you know, if they want to say, hey, I don't have to get really sophisticated or spend forever getting educated about a bunch of stuff that's really difficult to do. I just need to put in the time and here are some simple things I can do and catch fish with.
Walk us through this.
So the reason I put these priorities in a certain order, so, and those being when, where, how, and what, is simply because you sort of have to have one before you can go to the next and then to the next. And really what it all boils down to, Roger, is that all I'm trying to do is to simply fish in water where you have fish present and active fish, so that you're not casting into, you know, empty water and you're nowhere near any activity and you're wasting a lot of time there. And then, you know, maybe you get thrown off the trail and you're saying, okay, I'm just fishing the wrong fly, or I'm just fishing at the wrong depth and I'm not figuring it out. And whereby in reality, you might just be out there at the wrong time of the day, and there's something really great that's going to happen in an hour or two. But kind of if you don't start thinking in those terms, you can miss a whole lot, and you can miss an otherwise really easy situation if you're not sort of looking for it. So I always start with the stuff that's going to have you out casting the fish, and time of day, or if you think of it in terms of the bite going off, you really want to key into the stuff that's going to have you out there crossing paths with fish at the right time and when they're going to be active and when they're going to be displaying the kind of behavior where you can get out and actually have some success with them. So the easiest way to think about that, again, is just, okay, when the bite's on versus when the bite's off. So you start with that and put yourself out there at the right time of the day when they're going to be feeding. Then you've kind of checked that box, and that's sort of the biggest one, because any of the other stuff that you're going to do is going to be inside of that. And on the flip side, if the bite's off, none of this other stuff is really going to matter much, because there's nothing going on at some particular time of the day. So the method you're using, the flies you're using, kind of becomes a moot point. So that's the first thing. And then, of course, being out there when the bite's going on, and then being able to figure out for one reason or another where they're located. Because in most cases, you're not going to find where they're scattered all over the place and sort of distributed evenly throughout the lake. That happens on occasion, but usually they're in a certain area or they're concentrated for a reason, and whether that's because that's where the food is located, or that has to do with the conditions going on, the water temperature, and they want to be at a certain layer, or some other situation, but you want to find that part of the lake and that depth and so forth where you're going to be where the activity is and so forth. And really, if you can solve for those two things, you're in the right place at the right time. Now you're onto something, because now you're in the middle of the activity, and so your odds go way up. And in a lot of cases, if you can do that and simply put yourself so you're crossing paths with them, the other things are going to start to matter less and less. And I don't want to downplay the methods that you use and, your equipment, your lines, and the depths you're getting to, and the fly patterns you use, because those are also super important. But I just found in my own experience that unless I solve for the other two first and simply get out where the fish are located and that I'm casting to fish and active fish, that, that other stuff isn't going to matter nearly as much. And so then, of course, where you go from there, what I find is that third priority of kind of the method you're using tends to matter next, because now you're going out and you're starting to key in, okay, are they at some depth? Are they reacting to a faster retrieve, a slower retrieve? Different things like that that you start to dial in, that they're going to behave a certain way toward and that you're going to draw strikes toward and so forth. In my experience, that tends to be next, and that tends to matter more even than the fly pattern that you're using and so forth. And so again, it works the same way. If you solve for those three, then you're really, 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 really close, and a lot of times the fly may or may not matter, just depending on, where they're going to be and how they're behaving and so forth. And, this might make some people laugh, but I've even, just for the sake of experimentation, gone out and instead of using whatever the right fly was or the best fly to use, I've even taken a piece of duct tape, put it on a hook, put it down there to see if they really cared all that much when I had it all dialed in with the approach and so forth. And surprisingly, in a lot of cases, they really don't care. You put something in front of them and you present it the right way, retrieve it the right way, they're going to react to it. Because in some cases, maybe they know it's food, maybe they don't, but I think a lot of the time, the only way for them to find out if it otherwise moves naturally is they're just going to strike at it. And I think by the time that that's it.
Moving, by the, but probably alive.
By the time they can react, it might be too late if they're going to spit it out or whatever they're going to do. But it could be surprisingly easygoing once you get that far.
We did a show with Ralph Cutter where he did a lot of underwater stuff, and I've mentioned this on other subsequent shows that he was watching fish in a stream. Mm-hmm. They were taking anything and everything, sticks, rocks, stones, moss, mm-hmm. taking everything in. Doesn't mean they kept it in, but they were tasting everything because they didn't really know, And you're right, the timing was, it's going by me pretty fast here. Either I taste or I don't, And so he found that he learned a lot about that fish really do take in a lot of crap, and they spit mm-hmm. it out, but mm-hmm. you got to be quick enough to get the hook set before they do.
And I think of all things you can kind of arrive at with this stuff. That's one of the most interesting things, I think, that you mentioned right there, is that, I think we misunderstand them a lot of time, that trout are not that sophisticated. The behavior is not that tough to figure out. And you're right. They'll strike at most anything if they think it, because they're out there, they're trying to survive and they're trying to feed and everything like that. And so Yeah, if they're not sure or whatever it is, if it just appears to be food, you're right. They're going to go and claim it and then figure out later, you know, at least the behavior would support that I've found, that they'll hit most anything. If it's the right size and it's moving right, chances are they're going to strike at it in a lot of cases.
A couple of, well, two questions and from Chris in Brentwood, California, and Danny in Lake Tahoe, both mm-hmm. asked about what you look for, your approach to fishing new stillwater location. So say mm-hmm. it's brand new and maybe you mm-hmm. haven't done the research or maybe okay. you never fish stillwater without doing research. But mm-hmm. what's your approach there to like you know nothing about?
That's a great question because, again, I think the big challenge to stillwater is just you look out and there's just so much water and so much depth going on and so much mystery. And a lot of times you look out across and there's just nothing that's going to tip you off to what's going on and where the action might be, when it may occur, or anything like that. So it can be really mysterious and there can be kind of a lot of unknown and it can be overwhelming. That's how I would describe it. So the way I'll do it, you know, if you don't know anything different and the way, you know, I'll kind of pick it apart and so forth is, for one, I mean, I'll show up and I'll just decide that, you know, I'm going to be confident about it and I'm going to expect the best and I'm not going to say, oh, I've got to solve the puzzle this time out or, you know, I think I should get X number of fish. You don't want to put yourself into that kind of a situation. Just go out and say, however it goes, it goes. If I get skunked, that's fine. But by the time I leave today, I'm going to know more than I did when I showed up. So I think setting the right kind of expectation there is a smart thing to do. And the main thing, I mean, I do really simple things, but they tend to work. So one thing is I'll just simply plan to stay out there and be out there a long time. So you're going to show up at a place that you've never been before and you don't otherwise know anything about. And if you're just going to give it an hour or two, boy, for me, I'm not going to have great odds in that situation. So if I can plan a half day or the whole day or something like that, that's going to do a whole lot for me. Really simple as it sounds, but that type of thing. And again, it kind of goes back to managing time and the things that I was saying there. I'll keep track of what I'm doing and not spend too much time, you know, fishing any one certain area, depth, presentation, anything like that. And then as far as how I'm actually going to take to the water and go out and do the thing, for one, and it talks about it in the book there, I'll section the lake off and get a good kind of, I'll call it a statistical sample of the water and the type of terrain out there and so forth. So I'm going to spend some time, you know, fishing closer to the surface, fishing more down at depth, spend some time fishing along the shoals if I can find them. I'll take a good sample of the shoreline. But basically I'm going to fish like different types of terrain and different depths and so forth. And maybe I'm not going to cover the whole surface area of the lake, which is probably a common mistake guys will make going out somewhere for the first time. Is it's kind of like, well, if I can cover the whole lake and troll around the whole thing, I mean, they have to be somewhere. And I think you're better off if you spend your time concentrating maybe at one end of the lake and finding, if you can find a sample of, okay, here's some shoreline, here's some shoal area, here's kind of some drop-off and some deeper stuff, and just search all those different places and those different depths and so forth. That's probably going to tell you more than trying to take a tour of the entire lake. And it'll probably turn you on to activity a lot faster that way. And I think if you take a good sample like that, I mean, usually for me, even if it's a first time out, I mean, I'm going to know within the first hour if there's anything going on. In other words, if the bite's on or if it's off, I can usually determine that. And from there, the other thing obviously that I'll do is I'll be really open and really observant to, I mean, anything that constitutes a clue, I'll take whatever I can get. And so it's kind of a beggars can't be choosers thing. So if there are visible clues, food sources, or even things with maybe the conditions that day, you know, I pay attention to how the lighting is. And if it, you know, you hit a part of the day where, you know, it gets darker or if the weather changes or something with the water surface, I'll pay attention to all that kind of stuff and how I might think fish could react to it, because they tend to change their tune on a dime a lot of times and they'll react to a change in circumstances really fast. So anything you can find that might tip you off, any clue, anything that's going on at all, I'll try and observe and react to those things and follow all that around for lack of anything else. So I think just being open-minded and that type of thing is going to go a long
way.
But
I think you kind of concede maybe a first visit to learning more than anything else.
I think it's smart, yeah.
Yeah, without high expectations of, you know, high catch rates or anything. And I know, again, just from fishing this lake a lot by me, that, mm-hmm. and I still haven't learned this lake, and I don't know how many times I've been down there. I'm always learning. And you're right, it's kind of like the wind is always, you know, down here. I know, you know, like, it's kind of a waste of time to go down there at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. But I know for a fact that if I go the 3 hours before, sundown, that is prime time, and it's almost always good. And almost never disappoints me. So, you know, it's
exactly.
Like using your time wisely, too. I can really relate to what you said. You know, if you spend a whole day from morning till dusk at a lake, you're going to learn about a lot of things about that lake.
Yeah.
A lot about the wind part. And I can see why you put that first. Because if you're in the wrong place, you know, you may be in the right place at the wrong time, and you're going to get skunked, you know.
That's it. And it's really interesting about the simple stuff like that, because, again, you go out and even going, like we're talking about, to a new place that you're not familiar with or something like that, it's not going to be the sophisticated methods or the rocket science that's really going to turn you on to the fish that day. The interesting thing is, locally here, I've gone and I've listened to people in other disciplines, so, for example, steelhead fishers and people who fish the salt, who fly fish out for sea-run cutthroat or silver salmon or what have you. But the thing that's really funny about that, and it's exactly like it is in Stillwater, is the guys who are doing really well and having good success, they're always talking about the same simple methods, real easy things that you can do, that some of them, it's like they're so simple, you kind of bypass them, and you don't give them enough consideration, and sometimes we don't realize that that's the stuff that's going to put fish into your net, or that's going to find you success on the water, and it's just really simple stuff, sometimes so painfully easy and simple that, you know, you're looking for other more difficult, more sophisticated answers out there. And, a lot of it lays in just the simple and the few. That's what's interesting about
it. Okay. So we do have some questions about specifics here. So,
right?
Chris and Rodney were both, Rodney in Portland, Oregon, Chris mm-hmm. in California, both were asking about, you know, using sinking lines, your approach as far as retrieval speeds, you know, do you start fast, slow, how mm-hmm. deep do you go first? Do you work your way up or do you work your way down? So maybe you can kind of talk about that particular technique.
Yeah, and actually...
Maybe the flies that you're using
with
that as well. No, like
kind of fly. Okay. Yeah, actually both these guys, I like these questions because they also go a long way toward the approach that I take and a lot of the success that I've had. Because, again, I do, you know, method-wise, there's a small handful of stuff that I like to do, and I usually don't go off of that unless I'm just really stumped. And this is the stuff that usually works for me. But sinking lines, again, if you're going to start with one, you know, in my opinion, type 4, type 5, somewhere in there. So faster, but, I mean, not something that's, you know, just going to fall to the bottom like a rock. So usually something in that range is a good versatile line. And you know, and a good point to make here, and what we all know but maybe seldom think about, is that every sinking line out there is going to get to the bottom. And it's just a matter of how fast it's going to get there and in your approach, you know, what kind of depths are you working toward? Are you working in 6 feet of water or, you know, 26 feet of water, and you know, you can kind of dial in and get more specific about how fast you want that thing to sink. But I think earlier on, you're probably going to notice less of a difference. And I remember in my case, it was more a matter of sinking line versus floating line. And that's kind of the terms that I thought in. And I really wasn't at a point where I was ready to start considering different sink rates and things like that. And to this day, I'm still not that picky or that sophisticated where I have, you know, 6-8 different lines that I choose from. And I know a lot of guys are. It's just a matter of sort of what works for you and what preference you have and so forth. But, you know, so something that I guess if you're saying fast versus slow, I sort of tend to be in that medium fast range, I guess, if you're talking type 4,
I think you're talking
type 5.
I think you're talking more about, like, also retrieval rates, you know.
Yep. Okay, and so that's the other thing, and that's...
Yeah,
so I like that question, too, because that's probably the other thing. If I get made fun of for my float tube and the fly that I always use, that would be the third of three is the way that I retrieve. And probably anybody local that's going to listen to this is going to start laughing because I have this reputation for stripping ridiculously fast. And, boy, most of the time, Roger, I don't go off of that very much because it's surprising what kind of reaction it draws and how often it does. And even in, for example, winter conditions when the fish are known to be pretty lethargic and stuff like that, I've had surprising success with not just a fast strip, but I tend to do like a real broken motion. So I think if you imagine what the fly is doing under the water, it just sort of has that appearance of injured or frantic or kind of desperate to get away or whatever you want to call it. But I'll use a really fragmented, uneven, kind of an obnoxious rhythm. Kind of tough to describe without actually showing you. If you're watching me, and you know, I could show you with my arm, it'd be real simple. But in my mind, it's kind of a medium fast retrieve. But everybody tells me that it's like ridiculously fast. But I guess the one thing I know about that is that it draws a lot of reaction. And I think the way trout think, and the way they hunt, and the way they behave most of the time, they see that going on, and they're just going to go swat at it. And I think even in cases where maybe the feed isn't on all the way or they're less active, they might just strike it anyways just because out of instinct, or they're going to go slap at it or something like that. And sometimes I'll draw strikes when there's otherwise nothing going on, but I think they're just reacting to kind of a fast, obnoxious fly going through the water and that type of an approach. But it works for me.
And then the other part of Chris's question was, do you go deep first and work your way up, or shallow and work your way down?
So I like to go deep, and I like that too, because most of the time that I'm out there, if I'm going to be working beneath the surface or at depth, I'm just going to do a simple cast count retrieve type method. And especially if I've done some searching around and I'm in an area where I know there's some activity and now I'm really going to go after them. Again, it's a very simple thing that I do, so I'll just go out. Put the cast out there. And, you know, for me, usually I'm in maybe 15, 20 feet of water or could be less. And I'm simply going to put it out there. And probably the only challenge in that is counting it down long enough, because I think we have a tendency to think that it's deeper than it really is. So you want to make sure you're getting down there far enough. But, yeah, put simply, I'm going to put it out there, go toward the lake floor and get close to it or within sight of it. And then I'm going to strip back up. And usually, again, I'm going to strip up, you know, rather fast and rather obnoxiously and so forth. And at times, yeah, I'll change that retrieve, the rhythm of it or the speed of it. And I have, you know, at times I'll slow down if I'm getting the wrong kind of reaction or I think that's going to work better and I'm going to hook more fish. It's less often, but, you know, I always kind of stay open to changing my approach that way. But, yeah, most of the time that's what I'm simply going to do is just put it out there, count it down, and then rip it back rather fast and then just keep, you know, working the area that I'm in.
And when you're using this kind of technique, and make this real quick because we got to wrap things up.
Yeah.
What flies are you using primarily with that kind of, with the sinking line and that kind of
sure.
retrieval?
So beyond pattern? That, yep, so beyond the beadhead semi-seal that I use for kind of everything as a general purpose.
Okay.
Yeah, I love minnow patterns. So, for instance, like what's called a bullet head minnow or an epoxy head minnow, I really like those just for the way they cast and the way they move and sink and so forth. That's a really good one. What's the one? The ruby-eyed leech, which I think is a Brian Chan pattern, if I remember. That one I really like a lot. Again, the way that it casts and moves and so forth. So I use a lot of things that are kind of similar to each other. There's another one I think that's a little bit newer called a goat leech that doesn't have a bead or a weight to it, but I think it's got a wire wrap, so it's got a little bit different motion. That one tends to fly through the air really nice, and I've had good success with that one as well. And it's got kind of, a little bit of a thinner profile to it.
Okay.
But those
Good.
Are some examples.
Good. Well, yeah. Unfortunately, Tim, we're out of time, and we've got another page of questions here and some more on the Internet. So sorry, folks, we couldn't get to everything, but that's normally the case, and we do our best. But, Tim, stick with me here for a few more minutes because we're going to be giving away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a one-year subscription to Fly Fishing and Tying Journal and also a copy of your book, Stillwater Strategies, courtesy of Stackpole Books. So. Everyone, hold on just a few more minutes, and we'll do those giveaways and call it a night. A mining company called Pack Grim Coal is planning a massive strip mine near Anchorage, Alaska. The Chewitna Coal Project would be the first project in Alaskan history to to mine directly through salmon habitat, the Chewitna River drainage, 11 miles of it. Critical commercial, sport, and subsistence fishing economies would be permanently destroyed. PACRIM says it can rebuild a salmon stream, but scientific experts can find no example where successful restoration has occurred after strip mining. Chewitna coal would be shipped to Asia, leaving Alaska with nothing but devastated habitat and ruined salmon runs. It's time to stop the Chewitna coal strip mine. And for more information about how you can help, find out about it, you can go to www.inletkeeper.org. That's inletkeeper.org. Just a quick reminder to everyone, before you leave the website tonight, please take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find our link on our homepage in the section under tonight's show that says, what did you think of this show? Just click on that link and leave your comments. We should certainly appreciate it. Well, now it's time to give away a few of our prizes, and the winners from these drawings are going to be randomly selected from our show's registration database. If you didn't register for tonight's show, it's too late, but make sure you do so for the next show, and you'll have a chance of winning one of these great prizes then. So if you are the lucky winner, we'll contact you after the show and make arrangements for you to receive your gift. So the first thing we're going to give away tonight is a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers. And to learn more about the Federation, you can go to fedflyfishers.org, and they're a great organization to be a part of and to support. Our winner for that is Rich Starbird. Rich Starbird. And Rich is in Connecticut. So thank you, Rich, for playing, and congratulations on getting that one-year membership to the Federation. Now we'll give away a one-year subscription to Fly Fishing and Tying Journal, and that is courtesy of Amato Books. Amato Books publishes a lot of fly fishing and other types of fishing books and map books and all kinds of things. So go visit their website at AmatoBooks.com. And our winner for that is Sam Brown in Ohio. Sam Brown in Ohio. So congratulations, Sam, on getting that one-year subscription to Fly Fishing and Tying Journal. And now, Tim, we're going to give away your book. Clear my cue here, and the way we play this is that I'm going to ask a question, and it's going to be a two-part question tonight, and the first person to answer it correctly will win, and I'll make sure, Tim, that you make sure that I get the right answer for this.
All right.
Okay, two-part question. My cue's still not. Okay, looks like we're clear now. Okay, so on the page on our homepage, you can type in the answer. Be sure you put in your name and email address so you're all set to go there. Now, the question is, two-part question, what type of line, full sinking line, has Tim been talking about all night? And what was his other piece of equipment that he found very useful when out fishing still waters? Other piece of equipment that wasn't fly fishing related. So there you go, two-part question. And let's see what we've got here. So now they're, okay, I'm passing two up. Treg, nice try, but that was so much information, you're just doing a long shot, and I'm not going to give it to you.
Treg has won a number of times.
This time he went over the top, and, you know, when he answers, gives me answers to four different questions that I didn't ask, but still gets it right. So, Treg, you're going to have to hone it down there. I know Treg, so. Anyway, it looks like my first close one here is five type,
mm-hmm.
a sink rate, and a watch.
That's it.
That's it. Yeah, that's right, spot on. And that's Lane Mortensen in Antioch, California. So, Lane, great. I do have your email address. If you will send me your mailing address so we can get the book sent out to you from Stackpole, we will do just that. Now, you can send me your address in the same box you just answered the question in, or send it to info@askaboutflyfishing.com. info@askaboutflyfishing.com. So thanks a lot, Lane, for playing and winning that, and I'm happy for you, and congratulations. Well, Tim, really appreciate you being on the show with us tonight. It was fun having you on and learning more about your techniques and methods for fishing still waters, and I appreciate you being with us.
Yeah, thanks, Roger, and I'm really appreciate you thinking of me here.
Well, great, great. Well, our next broadcast will be on June 5th, 7 p.m. Mountain, 9 p.m. Eastern. On that show, we're going to interview Roger Fletcher, and our topic for the show will be drift boats and river dories. Roger is an educator, historian, and drift boat aficionado, and has a passion for drift boats and river dories. Learn more about their history, design, construction, and use on our show. And if you're thinking about building a boat, you might want to listen in because Raj knows how to do it, whether it be a full-size drift boat or just a model drift boat you can put on your den shelf. So don't miss this show. We'd like to thank the Federation of Fly Fishers, Amato Books, Stackpole Books, Keeney's Fly Shop, Royal Forge Anglers, and Flats Time Charters for sponsoring our show today. If you think your company would benefit from sponsoring one of our shows, give us a call at 1-800-985-1673, extension 8. We'll be happy to explain the options available to you. Don't forget to visit our website at askaboutflyfishing.com and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.